I see my light cook shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eugene Jarecki, who's an author and dramatic and documentary filmmaker whose works include Why We Fight, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, Reagan, Freakonomics, and his latest film, The House I Live In, which was nominated for an Academy Award in 2012. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eugene Jarecki.
Hey, great to be here, Ian.
And today, for you, I imagine, since your very important film documented the failed war on drugs and the growing prison industrial complex that has given the United States the dubious shame of having 5% of the world's population but 25% of the world's prisoners, it looks as though Attorney General Eric Holder is trying to do something about it and to reverse this rather disgraceful trend.
Right. I think it's the most significant development in the prospective reform of the American war on drugs in its 40-year history. And I think Attorney General Holder is to be incredibly commended for, particularly in these politically divisive times, for, putting first principles first where they belong, for expressing justice and conscience rather than this very stale and obviously failed and embarrassingly failed system of sort of industrialized and institutionalized callousness, which has been standard operating procedure for 40 years. He's put a major step forward. You imagine that social change happens in small increments. This is a significant leap happened. And so we're tremendously gratified about it.
Well, some of his rhetoric was quite powerful, where he talked about the vicious cycle of poverty, criminality, incarceration that traps too many Americans and weakens too many communities. I mean, that's the message from your film.
It is, and we were extremely happy to hear it. It seems to me that you never know who gets to see your film. I know that the Attorney General's office asked to see the film several months ago. That was a very proud moment for us to send it. We've also been in a lot of touch with Obama's Office of Drug Control Policy under Gil Kerlikowske, the director of that office, and have been working closely with members of the administration and also people at the legislative level from Congress in the person of Bobby Scott, Congressman of Virginia, but also Pat Leahy of Vermont and others, to try to move on this at the legislative level. All of this is stuff we've worked hard for. We've also worked hard on the ground to get the movie out to people who matter in prisons and churches and schools across the country, forgotten people that never get to have their voices heard on this. And I think Holder did something incredible. Remember, there are Californians hunger striking right now in prisons, and that's been spreading across the country. They're at several weeks now standing for something, far larger than themselves, and you almost have the feeling that Holder has heard them. And it's a very rare moment when truth gets spoken to power and power responds in a noble way. And God knows how this happened and what role everybody played, but it's a wonderful thing to be watching it happen and participating in it even as a spectator and a contributor.
Well, the fact that the Attorney General's office asked to see the film is encouraging, and one can assume that if he didn't see it, he was certainly briefed about it. But tell us about how the film began, because it has some very, very powerful people backing it, does it not?
It does. We've had a lot of terrific support, particularly in Hollywood circles. Brad Pitt and John Legend and Danny Glover and Russell Simmons are executive producers of the film, and the film came out theatrically and also on television and on public television, and then it's now available kind of all over on iTunes and Netflix and where people can see it. The most important thing for me is that it's a conversation starter and promoter for people to understand the extraordinary gravity of what we've done with our drug laws over 40 years. We've spent $1 trillion. We've had 45 million drug arrests. We have achieved nothing with it other than a record of total and embarrassing failure. America is the leading incarcerating nation on earth. We have 2.3 million people behind bars, more than any other nation. And for all that, drugs are cheaper, purer, more available than ever before, and used by younger and younger people than ever before. It would be hard to add anything that would make it a greater failure. So it should come as no surprise that the highest law enforcement official in the land, who wants a safer and more efficient system of criminal justice, would want to change it. It's just that business as usual in Washington has not suggested that over decades. So Holder is doing what one would think a responsible public figure should do. It's just in this day and age, that is astonishing. And it takes nothing away from, therefore, from the courage of what he's done and the sort of, and the backbone it requires to do that in today's Washington.
And again, I'm speaking with Eugene Jarecki, who is an author and dramatic and documentary filmmaker, whose latest film, The House I Live In, was nominated for an Academy Award in 2012. And Eugene, you're preceded on the program by Judge James Gray, who ran for president of the United States, or vice president, on the Libertarian Party ticket in 2012. And he indicates that there's a broad political support in terms of both libertarians and liberals. Do you think that's a winning coalition in terms of pushing this through? Because it's one thing for the Attorney General to make a speech. It's another thing to get these reforms enacted.
Sure. I think way too often there are polar extremes in this country that fail to see where they have common ground. So when you tell me that libertarians and liberals are finding themselves with common cause on this issue, more power to them, and more power to them for not letting what's different about them get in the way of what's the same. Look at Washington. Washington is hinging everything on its differences, and as a result, we have a completely, basically a shutdown government by any other name. And so it seems to me that if we could see some collaboration between liberals and libertarians on a subject, what is this? This is an unjust system that liberals don't like for that reason. It has deep racist overtones, which liberals don't like for that reason. And it is a record of embarrassment to our first principles, which liberals don't like, who want to stand by first principles that go long back in the American story. Libertarians are very concerned with bloated federal programs that that soak up American tax money and waste it into private interests, private pressure groups, and inappropriate profligacy. So there should be nothing surprising about them finding common cause. It's just all too often instead the groups, you know, get on other issues around which they have division rather than where they have union. This country can't tolerate that. It can't afford that anymore. It needs forward momentum in directions that will solve any number of the issues we face. And this is obviously, I would say, the most crucial one from a human rights perspective in the American story right now.
Well, I bring it up because the Congress, of course, are the reason for many of these draconian laws, particularly the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, which gives a minimum sentence of 5 years without parole, mandating that for possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine, while the same sentence was mandated for possession of 500 grams of powder cocaine. And that's one of the more egregious examples. So when you have a system that has expanded so extraordinarily, 800% in the last few years, you really have, clearly, you've got to get Congress on board, or you've got to change these laws.
For sure. And I think one of the ways we try to do that is by using the film to make it clear, as has happened several times in American history, that there is a system at work that no longer is acceptable in modern terms. Once upon a time, that was slavery, and it had to end. Then it was women's suffrage, which had to happen. Then it was the civil rights movement. Along the way, you know, we saw in South Africa that there was a moment where we went from apartheid as a condition that is persistent to an apartheid as a condition that is no longer acceptable. In the modern world, we do actually put to rest systems that violate basic premises of decency and sort of internationally recognized norms. The American drug war is a grotesque. If you described its conditions to an everyday person and you didn't say it was the United States, you'd think you were describing the criminal justice system of a third world dictatorship. So that is long overdue to be changed. And it just seems to me that, what we're seeing in Congress is the need to remind more Congress people that where it once might have seemed safe and politically clever to appear tough on crime, now that the Attorney General himself is using the language smart on crime, which many of us have been using for some time, especially Obama's mentor, Charles Ogletree, who's in my film, once he's using that, it's going to become awfully difficult for Congress people to keep hawking tough on crime rhetoric that does nothing but hurt the American people to benefit private interests and a sort of prison industrial complex that feeds on human life for its own gain. We just need to keep embarrassing that until it becomes no longer an acceptable mode of American business, and then we'll move to the business that should lie in the public health treatment of addiction, which is what we're really dealing with here. We wrongly treated addiction as a crime. It never was a crime. It never should have been categorized that way, and we are coming to see the light that there is a better way to do this. We are late. Other countries like Portugal have been at it for 10 years with great success. We are just waking up to that a little bit slowly.
Well, Eugene Turecki, is that also, though, a problem on the part of those that have advocated drug reform, in as much as they've allowed the status quo, the prison industrial complex, for the want of a better description, to frame reformers as those that would legalize drugs, when in fact the argument is not to legalize drugs, but to medicalize drugs?
Yeah, I think legalization is a dangerous term, partly because it's been so stigmatized by its enemies, that to use it now is to use the language of the enemy. I think that makes no sense. Most Americans hear legalization and they correctly think, oh, that must mean, you know, cats and dogs living together and night of the living dead on every corner with people sort of hawking drugs to your child. But I think legalization is a problematic word for another reason, which is a government like our own has a responsibility to deal with a major public health issue, as which drugs are. And so to simply give the government a get-out-of-jail-free card, to say to the government, you've spent 40 years grotesquely profiting on this issue and not benefiting the people who needed protection and needed the involvement of a responsible government with a health care approach, instead of letting you now off the hook for that so that we just legalize and create a free-for-all, I'm not going to let you get off the hook. I'm going to say you now need to play the responsible role that you chose to play after Prohibition. When Prohibition blew up in our face, it's not that we then legalized alcohol and went nuts with it. What we did was said it's a controlled substance. Grown-ups can use it responsibly. Children cannot use it or be sold it. It's a crime to sell it to a child. And also, if you take alcohol and you combine it with an existing crime or accident in the public space, if you take your car out and hit somebody with it and kill them, that's going to be manslaughter. But if you were drinking, it's going to aggravate the charge. Well, that's a controlled substance, and that ought to be the way that we approach drugs in conjunction with other laws we have. No drug on the schedule of illegal drugs in this country is anywhere near as dangerous as alcohol, and yet we have far more stringent laws for drugs. How does that possibly make any sense? Well, it doesn't, and the Attorney General's step today is one more step, but a very meaningful one, toward making the conversation a rational one that moves us toward treatment and away from law enforcement.
Well, of course, the ironic legacy of Prohibition was that it resulted in organized crime, not to mention that Henry Ford was creating the world's biggest distillery of grain alcohol to fuel his cars. And here we are finally spending all this money on subsidizing gasohol or, you know, alcohol for cars when Prohibition killed it back when Henry Ford was trying to make it the norm here in America.
Yep. So we decided to repeat this idiocy, and the good news is Attorney General Holder is beginning to show some wisdom, really leading the way in terms of this in the American government. I think people need to support him tremendously, and they need to put pressure on their Congress people to support him tremendously and to see a moment where we can actually break free of the grip of tough on crime. Tough on crime is just one of the things that's like doping in the bicycle world. If one person does it, all of a sudden everybody has to do it. Well, somebody started being tough on crime once upon a time. It was Nixon. He wasn't really tough on crime, but he pretended to be. And once he pretended to be and won an election that way, everybody decided, oh, the only way to win elections in America is to scare people about the danger of their neighbor. Well, if we keep doing that, we're just going to bankrupt the country this way. So we should and must find a better approach. And I think this opens up the possibility for a smart on crime conversation. The greatest thing he did was to use those three words, smart on crime. Let's lay tough on crime and therefore the war on drugs to rest. Put it on the ash heap of history. Let's now be smart on crime and figure out what is a crime from what is simply an addiction, an affliction, something that needs medical care, not law enforcement.
And the Attorney General, in mentioning that the war on drugs cost $80 billion in 2010 alone. He also talked about, of course, the human and moral costs that are impossible to calculate. Do you think that, I mean, you have some of the conservative states already, Texas, for example, already seem to be getting the message and making changes and trying. And California, of course, has a prison overcrowding problem that the federal government is involved in and putting pressure on the governor in California who's been trying to appeal to the Supreme Court to get off the hook. So what's your sense in terms of whether this is like a double-barreled approach, both a moral argument and a practical argument?
Well, when you combine the moral and the economic, which is to say, if you that's really what I was mentioning earlier when I say that it's a joint venture between liberals and libertarians. The libertarians are not saying I'm opposed to the drug war by and large for moral reasons. They're saying this is a ridiculously failed, gigantically expensive federal program, $80 billion alone in 2010 with no results. How do we possibly argue for the continuation of that while cutting, but while showing austerity in other areas? Where's the austerity for the war on drugs? So that's their view. And then the liberal view is, how can we possibly in 2013, with an African-American president and a legacy of struggle to get to an enlightened place, how can we possibly be repeating not only the stupidity of prohibition, the disaster of that, but so much of the horrors of Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, which talks about the drug war in exactly those terms. How can we be so regressive? So there is a moral calling to make ourselves live up to the founding principles we all espouse. And yet there's also a practical economic calling to say this country can't afford this kind of insanity. So, yes, he is right to play on both sides of that because both matter, and this is a great opportunity for both to be met with one solution. You kill two very important birds with one stone.
And, of course, the Attorney General did mention the disparity in sentencing where blacks are sentenced 20% longer than whites.
Yeah, and that's a newly improved statistic. It's been far worse over time, so he's great to mention it. There are even more harrowing statistics, but I think he probably is cautious about coming across as too much of a heavy breather, so he gives the one that sounds most reasonably controllable. And there are far worse statistics than that 20% one. That sounds rather manageable to most people. The reality is, for example, that with crack cocaine, we've always thought crack was a black drug. Well, it turns out the majority of crack users in America are and always have been white. I never knew that. I only learned it while making my film. And what I also learned is that black people only represent 15% of the country, and they are 15% of the crack users. So not only does that make the majority of crack users white in America, but you then have to deal with the harrowing reality that in our federal courts, 90% of those charged with crack offenses are black. So 15% of people using crack are black, yet 90% of those charged are black. Now, that's a statistic I want people to hear.
Well, you can also add to the fact that the majority of people using food stamps are white and the majority of people that are poor in this country are white. So there's a lot of reasons why we should revisit most of those sort of prejudicial statistics that we have. But do you think that given that your film covers the journey of so many people from the inner cities into these overcrowded prisons, and you have testimony from drug users, from judges, from narcotics officers, from prison guards, and they're all acknowledging this broken system. One of the things that I hadn't heard about before that the Attorney General brought up was the school-to-prison pipeline, where he said that those zero-tolerance school discipline policies instead serve as a gateway to the criminal justice system. A minor school disciplinary offense could put a student in the principal's office, should put a student in the principal's office, not in a police precinct. What's he talking about there? I mean, this is one aspect of it that I wasn't aware of.
Well, sure. I mean, it even goes further. It can even be understood as a cradle-to-prison pipeline. I mean, you know, we have companies like the Corrections Corporation of America that talk to its shareholders in ways that would blow your mind. It's harrowing on a level that I.G. Farben didn't aspire to. They talk about how they make predictions about their future earnings as a prison corporation based on the childhood performances of people in inner cities, based on the test scores of young people. They can tell you who will fill those beds. In other words, they are banking on the demise of American urban and rural communities for their betterment. And so that kind of a pipeline is not just school to prison, it's cradle to prison. It is a construct that assumes a system that runs on human beings for its livelihood, and it counts on the despair of those human beings as a source of business profit, as a source of, you know, economic profit. It can't get more harrowing. It's just time. It's got to end. This is like talking about it's a gulag reality underlying whatever veneer the American public lives with. And the Attorney General has done a great service in bringing a big chunk of this to light, but of course the battle's just beginning and the implementation will be terribly important. And I give him all the support I possibly can. And I want, you know, anyone listening and anyone, you know, aware of this issue to speak to their congresspeople about how important implementation is, that they have the courage to be smart on crime. Because you no longer have to be as courageous as you used to be. It is too expensive to be tough on crime. It is un-American to be tough on crime. It's un-Christian. It's uneducated. It's anti-scientific. It's completely failed. And so you don't have to be a genius to say, well, maybe there's a better way to do this. It used to be that you could fear-monger people into being tough on crime. I don't think that works anymore. So I think he's just led the way to say, hey, guys, the water's warm in here. Why don't you come in, you know, into this area where it's a bit more humane and a bit less wasteful?
Well, just in closing, Eugene Turecki, given that the Attorney General has opened the door here, it would seem to me this is a good moment for people across the country to get your film that lays out this whole story of how we got to this position and the full scope of this enormous human and economic tragedy that is, as I mentioned in the opening, is America's shame. Are there ways for communities to get hold of your films? In other words, to create a political movement, to put some wind at the back of the Attorney General?
Absolutely. They can go to our website, which is thehouseilivein.org. They can also follow us at Drug War Movie on Facebook and on Twitter. And I think what they can do there is they can see the film in a lot of different ways. It's on Netflix. It's on iTunes. I frankly don't care if people pirate the movie. People should see it however they want to. If they go on the website and they want to communicate with us, we can help them set up screenings in communities around the country. There's a Get Involved clickable button on our website where you can write to us and you can fill out a form that arranges a screening in your area, and we can also do that in conjunction with your policymakers in a local way. We get very hands-on involved with anybody who wants to show the film, and whether it's in a church, a prison, a school, a community center, a state house, all of that is welcome. We do it every day. And we really welcome contact from people who get to see the film or who want to see the film. But please do follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Those are good ways of being aware of what is happening, both with the drug war on its own and also with our efforts to contribute to it.
And again, the website is?
Website is just the title of the movie, thehouseilivein.org.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Eugene Turecki.
Thank you, Ian. It's nice to talk about something positive happening in the world.
Indeed, and I'm grateful. Again, I've been speaking with Eugene Turecki, who is an author and dramatic documentary filmmaker whose works include Why We Fight, The Trials of Henry Kissinger, Reagan, Freakonomics, and his latest film, The House I Live In, which was nominated for an Academy Award in 2012. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how the threats we face compared to our bloated military budget look puny and paltry.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.